It's so nice to have you back, Larry.
Good to be back.
Yeah. Let's get started with the latest comment of Netanyahu. He says that they are very close to eliminating Hamas. And does it have anything to do with the reality?
Well, that's a preposterous contention, but it's certainly one to be expected from Bibi. I was watching him maybe 30 minutes ago as the man was working on my air conditioner. And I marvel at his cleverness in when he speaks in English and when he speaks in Hebrew. Usually when he's speaking to the Israelis in English, you know he doesn't give a damn about the Israelis. He's talking to the Americans and others who speak English. And when he speaks Hebrew to the Israelis, he's speaking to the Israelis in a way that he doesn't want the Americans to understand. He's very clever in that regard. And being multilingual like that augments his cleverness and power. But when he slips up and he talks about things with a vengeance in his voice, as he did in Hebrew about the Philadelphia quarter, and then broke over to the other side of the screen and spoke in English about it, you understand his personal reasons for doing what he's doing. It's to stay in office. When he declares the Philadelphia quarter an essential element of destroying Hamas, he's telling you that it's an essential element of an impossibility. He's not going to destroy Hamas. And he's also telling the Egyptians that he doesn't trust them at all. You can't handle the Philadelphia quarter. So I'm not ever going to leave it. But his strategic objective to eliminate Hamas, and he said it in English, he said two aspects of that: eliminating them physically on the ground and eliminating any potential that they would ever have politically to rule Gaza again or to in any way influence Gaza in a political sense. Both of those are impossible tasks. So you're led back to the real reason he's exhibiting all this cleverness in both Hebrew and English, denigrating the Egyptians too at the time, the only people he has a peace treaty that really matters with, is to stay in office. To stay in political office. At the same time, as I mentioned the other day, I believe, at the same time that primary objective holds itself before him, he has got to consider the wing of his cabinet, the wing of his political coalition that's keeping him in office, really, when it comes down to one that could oust him overnight. And that's Ben-Gvir and the people associated with him. And what they're doing, of course, is already in Gaza. They're already in northern Gaza, and they're beginning to do what they did on the West Bank and will complete in the Golan in East Jerusalem. And that's another thing. The reason this onslaught on the West Bank has started up is not so much because Hamas has infiltrated the West Bank and is doing things from there, gaining succor and, you know, drinking water and food and everything else and associating with the Palestinians on the West Bank, which is what the Israelis are saying is happening. The only reason that he's renewed the effort in the West Bank is not to eliminate them. That secondarily is to use the cover of Gaza to finish off the West Bank on the West Bank, to finish it off. We want everything is what he's saying. And we will not stop until we have everything. And this conflict and a ceasefire will not happen until we have everything or very close to everything. And Ben-Gvir is hard at work in Gaza, colonizing Gaza or settling Gaza. That keeps him out of jail. It keeps the war going. It keeps the possibility that things might get really, really bad. Does he want that incidentally to it? Maybe he does, because what happens if the IDF really runs out of steam, which I'm hearing they are doing rather rapidly? This is a group that was designed, trained, educated, whatever you want, to do blitzkrieg war. Yes, it's been in occupation status for a long time and its skills have atrophied to a certain extent, but that's not a plus, that's another negative. It is now very, very tired. It is very, very fatigued. More call-ups will make the economy even worse. The economy is terrible right now. It's falling apart right now. I think that's part of the motivation in COVID, if not solid, of the protests growing so much in Tel Aviv in particular. So he's got to keep this prospect of a wider war alive. And if he wants his ultimate aim, which is to take out the Iranian nuclear program done by the United States, he's got to keep it spreading and escalating. And so he's got all these balls to juggle right now. And watching him juggle them in both Hebrew and English to two different audiences is fascinating, if not surreal, and not really despicable, because people are dying. And he does not give a tinker's damn about those hostages, regardless of the Hebrew smarm he put out or the English smarm that he put out. He, like Tony Blinken, does not give a tinker's damn about those hostages. They can all die if he stays in power and if he accomplishes what he wants to accomplish. And what he wants to accomplish is what I just described.
Larry, it seems that they had a deal on October 9th or 10th. They had an offer from Hamas to release all those civilian hostages, but they rejected that offer. And do you understand right now if they're thinking the same way?
Well, I don't understand exactly what that slide meant. Do you mean that we have discovered, or someone's discovered, that they had a deal
that it says that the time of Israel, it says that we later found that Hamas had offered on October 9th or 10th to release all the civilian hostages in exchange for the IDF not entering this trip, but the government rejected the offer.
Now, do you mean the IDF not entering the strip until after the exchange, and then they could?
No, not entering, just having
not entering
a deal.
At all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At all.
Well, that's preposterous. There's no way the Israelis were going to do that. And I frankly would not have advised that had I been a military advisor to the Knesset or to the prime minister or whatever. They were just attacked. If someone knows something I don't know now, if Netanyahu really was complicit with October the 7th, if other people in Israel were complicit with it, wanted it to come, and were designing it to do what they're doing now, then that's an altogether different affair. And if Hamas had any inkling of that, and therefore offered to stall that by returning the hostages, that's another matter altogether. But I don't know why the leadership of Hamas, if they thought that might be the case, or knew through Qatar that was the case, I don't know why they would offer that. Because they know the Israelis are coming after them, regardless of whether the hostages are released or not. They have to understand, and I can't believe that Hamas's leadership would have been this obtuse, whom they're dealing with. They're dealing with Bibi Netanyahu. And Bibi Netanyahu has extraneous objectives and reasons to be doing what he's doing that really have nothing to do with the fundamental security of the state of Israel. In fact, I could make a really good case for their having not only nothing to do with the fundamental security, but being injurious to that security. And I think you could corroborate that right now with the number of people who are watching what's happening to Israel that are saying things like Israel has never been in this weak a position in its short history. It's never been in this weak a position.
It seems that anytime they're getting close to have any sort of agreement, Israeli government's doing something unbelievable just to sabotage all the talks when it comes to all.
Not the Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah.
Now, they're with him, of course. He's the prime minister. But I would go so far as to say there is not going to be any ceasefire, and there's not going to be any peace agreement until Bibi Netanyahu says there's going to be one. Joe Biden notwithstanding, and Biden made a fairly strong statement about, you know, where we are right now. Others have made fairly strong statements. The British, actually, you probably know, the British actually put some stops on some of the weapons, the more heinous weapons that they were sending over there. I think we're going to see more of that. Is it going to steamroll? Is it going to blogger? You know, probably not. But we are seeing some actions that look quite different from those actions that we were seeing a month ago in terms of the U.S. and others who might bring some pressure to bear on Israel, not to mention the pressure that I think might be building in the Arab countries themselves. Then watching in particular MBS and in particular Sisi and a couple of other, shall we say, princelings who often come out and say things on behalf of their potentates. And some of the things they've been saying are very different from things they were saying a month or 2 months ago. A month or 2 months ago, you saw the Saudis in particular leading an effort, I think, behind the scenes and sometimes public, to put out the word that let's get this over with so we can get on to the excellent diplomacy we were working on beforehand. We want that high-tech relationship with Israel. We want things to calm down. No longer. Now what you're hearing is words of disbelief about how far the Israelis have taken this slaughter in Gaza. Words of disbelief about what's. I think they're right. Don't even talk about the Lancet article. I mean, look at other people. Look at other people who are now saying there are 200,000 dead Palestinians. And if you clear the rubble, you'll probably find another 10 or 15,000. And oh, by the way, there's going to be 20% of that more from starvation and other things that are happening to them right now. And these interludes to give polio vaccines are, you know, they're nice, they're helpful, but they don't solve the major problem. So I think there are people in the world right now whom I wouldn't have thought would come along because they were just waiting for this to be over. They just wanted it to be over and to go back to the, you know, the sort of status quo with a lot of Palestinians dead nonetheless, but go back to the status quo. I'm not hearing that anymore. I'm hearing some really harsh words about the state of Israel. And I'm hearing some really harsh words about the state of Israel. Whereas before, most of the harsh words I was hearing were about Bibi Netanyahu. Get rid of Netanyahu, get him out of there, and things will calm down a little bit and we can deal with them. We can get back to where we were before. I'm not hearing that anymore. What I'm hearing is not a universal condemnation of the state of Israel, but as close to it as I ever thought we would get in my lifetime.
Hear what he said, Larry. You said he talked in English and in Hebrew, and hear what he said in Hebrew.
Until we left that place. This is the state of Israel. This is Egypt. And you can see the Gaza Strip. It is not far from Tel Aviv, not far from Beersheba, and it's, of course, just meters away from the Gaza envelope. But we had an international border, which was from the sea all the way to Eilat. That was the international border of Israel. I would like, if I can, to zoom in. And if you look at this while zooming in, you see that all of these borders, the navy, the marine border is ours, but the land border is not. Ashkelon, Sderot, the kibbutzim, Kerem Shalom, and down below, the Philadelphia corridor, all the way down to Rafah, all of these are under Israeli control. The Philadelphia corridor, which separates Egypt from the Gaza Strip, will not be evacuated. If Israel will give up control of it, Gaza will become an enclave of terror. When I resigned from the government, when I realized that they were going to do the disengagement and they were going to break up these Jewish communities, I gave my letter of resignation to Prime Minister Sharon, and I said in it that the minimum requirement of mine was to leave the Philadelphia corridor in Israeli control. So it's nothing new. It was clear that if we do not have this route, they will be getting armed. They will create a monster.
I love it when he gets his map and his little guide and he points at things. I remember when he came to the UN with the bomb. Remember the picture of the bomb? He must think he must think that the rest of the world is truly stupid and that he is truly brilliant. And that all he has to do is evince that brilliance in Hebrew or English to that rest of the stupid world, and everyone will believe him. Well, okay. That's why you have to have the West Bank too, right? Right? Because Syria presents an even more dangerous problem than Egypt. And that's why you have to have the other part of the West Bank, because you really don't trust the other people who have a treaty with you either, called Jordan. And that's why you have to have everything that you're looking at, Golan Heights, even though the UN declared that illegal, and passed a resolution to that effect. You've got to have all of this because, and he will say to you in English and to Israelis in Hebrew, go stand there. Go stand anywhere near the Golan. Go stand on the West Bank and tell me Israel was secure unless we hold that land. He wants the whole kit and caboodle. He wants everything. And the next thing he'll be saying is he needs a portion of Egypt to protect the Philadelphia corridor. The next thing he'll be saying is I need room in Jordan to ship about a million Palestinians to. This is Bibi Netanyahu. Give him an inch and he takes a mile. No, he takes 4 miles. This is Bibi Netanyahu. And he's very good at doing this sort of thing and getting away with it. But let's face it. Bibi Netanyahu, like Arik Sharon before him, Ariel Sharon, they called him Arik, and like other Israeli prime ministers to a lesser extent, gets away with it because of the United States of America, period.
Larry, they're talking about the United States sets 2-week deadline for Gaza ceasefire talk. Do you see the Turkish official is talking about this? Do you see any sign of having or reaching any sort of agreement? And the way that Antony Blinken is implementing the foreign policy of the United States?
I think Chaz Freeman, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, is absolutely right that Tony Blinken has taken the U.S. Department of State to levels that Thomas Jefferson is rolling in his grave over, the first U.S. Secretary of State. And I don't think we're anywhere near a ceasefire until Bibi says he wants a ceasefire. And I think all the obfuscations coming out of Blinken and Sullivan and the president and Harris and others, notwithstanding, we are not going to have a ceasefire until Bibi Netanyahu believes it's conducive to 2 things. 1, his staying in political office and not going to jail. And 2, his crazy scheme of destroying Hamas utterly and completely, which he knows is impossible, but will last for as long as he needs. There's not going to be a ceasefire. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they announce one tomorrow morning, at least a short one, so they can exchange, get the hostages back that are still alive. And so that possibly the Palestinians can get some people out of jail, which have been there for years and years and years, for, you know, with about as much rights in that jail as, God, no rights at all. I mean, my understanding of their experience in Israeli jails is sort of like the Lubyanka in the old Soviet Union, or in Stalin's Soviet Union. So that would be a positive development. Don't get me wrong. I would really like to see the hostages released and every one of them come back safe and sound. But I think that's the very last interest, if it's an interest at all, of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Yeah. You talk about Kamala Harris. Do you think, is she helping herself and her campaign in 2024 with what, with her strategy in Gaza? Because I don't know if you saw his latest interview on CNN. I'm going to play it for you just to remember it.
Biden has tried unsuccessfully to end the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. He's been doing it for months and months, along with you. Would you do anything differently? For example, would you withhold some U.S. weapons shipments to Israel? That's what a lot of people on the progressive left want you to do.
Let me be very clear. I am unequivocal and unwavering in my commitment to Israel's defense and its ability to defend itself. And that's not going to change. But let's take a step back. October 7, 1,200 people were massacred. Many young people who were simply attending a music festival Women were horribly raped. As I said then, I say today, Israel had a right, has a right to defend itself, we would. And how it does so matters. Far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. Mm-hmm. We have to get a deal done. This war must end.
In the meantime,
and we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this to the families, to the people who are living in that region, a deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed since I've been on October 8 to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution, where Israel is secure, and in equal measure, the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
Larry, if you were to advise her campaign, what would you say to her and her campaign and the people around her?
I'm sad to say, Nima, if she wants to get elected, she probably has to do precisely what she described in that interview, though I realized that was a while back. And I am sad to have to say that, but that's probably the case. I'm condemning about 60% of America to being really either ill-informed or being so mesmerized by the Israeli situation that they don't bother to look into it a little more closely. And she needs a good portion of that group to be elected. So I don't necessarily fault her, even though I quiver as I hear her talking. She wants to say something. I can feel that she wants to say something, but she knows she best not. And so she holds herself back and tries to say both things at the same time. I understand that from a political perspective. She's not blessed with a very intelligent electorate. Let's put it that way. The second aspect of it, though, is that I don't hear anything different of consequence that might be a cure, if you will, for this situation once she is in office, if she is elected. I hope I'm just not hearing it because of what I just said, that she can't let any of that leak. But if she's really serious about it, and she's serious about capturing some of those people who are departing the Democratic Party in terms of voting for, and maybe even in terms of being Democrats in the future because of this situation, if she's serious about healing those wounds and those schisms, then she's going to have a plan for when she is president of the United States. And I'm very disappointed to hear that that plan seems to be, that's all I heard, and I realize what I've just said and qualifying it politically speaking, two-state solution. It's dead. It's dead. And it's dead mostly because of us in Israel. And I say that in tandem because Israel wouldn't be doing what it's doing if it didn't have all the support it needs from us. There is no possibility of a two-state solution unless you want to Bantustan the Palestinians, which I increasingly think might be the idea ultimately when Netanyahu is gone, a new Israeli government is installed, and we get some calm and maybe a little peace and certainly a ceasefire. Then we'll talk about how we're going to Bantustan the Palestinians. In other words, a little place here for the Palestinians, and a little place here for the Palestinians, and a little place here, and we'll call them Israeli citizens, and they'll be third and fourth class. They'd be like the blacks in 1955 in Jackson, Mississippi. Hell, the blacks today in Jackson, Mississippi, in many respects. That's what they will be like. And we will be, oh, this is wonderful. This is terrific. We've handled the Arab problem in Palestine. We've done our deed. That's my greatest fear. I'll probably be dead, but we'll get down to a solution to this, and that will be the solution, that Israel will rule everything that it is in right now and more. There'll be a few Palestinians left, and they'll be living in little enclaves that everyone will be, oh, isn't that so peaceful? They'll be living like they live, for example, in Nazareth. where they're third and fourth class citizens, but there's so many of them that they do have a fairly decent livelihood and they can become members of the Knesset, though they are denigrated in front of their faces in the Knesset, and they're never going to be full citizens. That's what I see us advertising and us backing and us supporting as we come out of this incredibly despicable situation we're in today. In other words, back to the status quo ante, but with a lot of different wrappings. Instead of big fences, fencing people off and everything. And I'm not saying they won't put fences around these Palestinian enclaves, these little countries inside Israel. But the two-state solution is not going to work. We've killed it. We've murdered it. We murdered it and murdered it and murdered it for the last 40 years. We made Dennis Rosses of the world, the Bibi Netanyahus, the Ariel Sharons, the Ehud Baraks. They all made it an impossibility. And now we're paying, the Palestinians are paying, but Israel's paying too. I'm not sure Israel's going to be the same again. I am not sure Israel is going to be the same again. If it insists on remaining where it is as a Jewish state, it is going to do this and do this and do this. I don't care how they accommodate the few remaining Palestinians they accommodate. They are going to have Hamas's, Hezbollah's, Iran's, Syria's, and they're going to have to deal with them. And it's going to be exactly what people have predicted a Jewish state in that region would be, a national security state that does nothing but arm and hope that the wars are not too frequent.
Terry, we've heard that the United Kingdom, the government in the United Kingdom is not interested in supporting any more what's going on in Gaza in terms of sending weapons and to Israel. And here is Jeremy Corbyn asking the UK Foreign Minister Secretary about this.
It's made by the ICJ and the ICC. You'll also be very well aware that the world has condemned Israel for its illegal occupation of the West Bank, the settlement policy, and the killing of 40,000 people in Gaza. The suspension of some arms contracts, could he explain what effect that will actually make on Israel's ability to continue the bombardment of Gaza, or will it continue unabated? And will he also explain what role, legally or otherwise, Britain has played in overflying Gaza with surveillance aircraft and the use of RAF Akrotiri as a staging point for aircraft going to Israel, which many people believe are carrying weapons that are used to bomb Gaza?
Secretary.
I know that the Right Honourable Gentleman is informed on many aspects of these issues. He must know that our exports to Israel amount to about 1%. And in fact, it is the United States and Germany and others that are much more engaged in the selling of arms to Israel. So when he asks me the effect, he can draw his own conclusions in relation to that. I am very comfortable with the support that we give to Israel, and I won't comment on operational issues as he would expect from this dispatch box.
We only kill a few, so we're not as guilty as the big guys. We only kill a few. But let me just say this. Jeremy Corbyn, of course, is not necessarily a very powerful figure in the parliament. Let me just say this. I'm watching the elections. It's beginning. It's starting. In Germany, it's unfolding pretty much the way I thought it was going to. It's going to do the same thing in other countries. We saw this incredible meeting, you know, in Bratislava, I guess it was, or maybe they moved to Prague. They had to move to Prague because Slovenia was not necessarily on their side anymore. The meeting about Ukraine is winning and so forth, the article that you sent me to read. This is all changing. And over the next year, year and a half, 2 years, you're going to see a different Europe. You're going to see a completely different Europe. And there are going to be people who are going to question the governments before them and their support of Israel in many ways. And also Ukraine, and Ukraine will probably be more resplendent in that regard because it's right there cheek and jowl with them. So we're looking at a Europe that is going to do a major transformation over the next 24 to 36 months, governments and its policies and such. Viktor Orban and other countries are not going to be like Slovenia and like increasingly the Czech Republic, I hear, are not going to be the only holdouts. You're going to have dissension all across Europe, I think. Is this healthy? Is this good? I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out. If Europe falls apart amongst its own components and we have a real problem like we've had in the past in Europe, then it's not going to be a positive thing. But one thing I know is going to come out of that, whether Trump's elected or Harris is elected, and whoever follows on, I think, is the more important chief executive in the United States. It's probably going to mean the United States withdrawal in a major way from Europe and concentration on where it should be concentrating, China. That said, for the present circumstances, I think we're looking at until the U.S. election takes place and one person or the other is confirmed, and that's not necessarily a given deal, and there's no revolution in the streets and no other unrest that takes the attention away from overseas situations, until we see that, we're going to have more of the same, I think. And we're going to have people fighting tooth and nail to maintain one side or the other side of the argument when both sides are collapsing, when the NATO relationship is collapsing, when 32 countries, 31 countries, whatever the total is now, is so unwieldy that people began to realize it. And money becomes an issue, and not money made by defense contractors, but tax dollars in these different countries. I think we're going to see a real change in the way Europe deals with things. And London is caught in the middle. Brexit was not just metaphorical. They're caught in the middle with no place to turn to on the continent. And the only big daddy they can suck up to is in Washington. And I suspect that there's going to be a great awakening in England and in Great Britain as a whole at the same time that these convulsions happen in Europe. So we're going to look at a very different world, I think, in 2 or 3 years. And that's a very short space of time. It's going to be a very different world. And security relationships are going to configure very differently. We're in a multipolar world. There's no question about it. China is already the hegemon in East Asia. The United States can contest it with freedom of navigation operations and everything else, but they are the hegemon. More and more people will gravitate there like a magnet sucking people in. Central Asia is awakening again from all the way from Turkey's borders to Xinjiang province in China. Russia and Ukraine have perturbated this a little bit, but they'll settle that down and you'll see the pipelines. The pipeline situation. I once had a guy from ExxonMobil take me into a room, which was sort of like a control room, one of their control rooms. And I looked at the future in that room. This is years ago when I was chief of staff at the State Department, years ago. I looked at the future. Pipelines under construction, pipelines contemplated, and pipelines pumping. I looked at that. And one of the things I saw on there was like looking at a map of empires of the future, of wealth of the future, of economies of the future, because they're doing the kinds of things that need to be done to harness what is necessary for economic success in this part of the 21st century. Now, you can talk about climate change and you can talk about morphing into new fuels and such, but for the time being, 40 to 60 years, probably, we're going to be doing this. And when you look at the state of Texas, for example, which has a negative value on natural gas, we call it natural gas, it's really methane. Negative value because they have no pipelines and no way to get it out of the Permian Basin and sell it. That's how unforward looking they were. That's how stupid they were in Texas. You look at East Asia and you look at Central Asia, they've not only got pipelines pumping, but pipelines under construction and pipelines on the drawing board. They have got them going everywhere. That's the future. And that's where the future is. And we're behind. We're behind. And we're going to figure that out. We're going to figure out that we have $50 trillion in aggregate debt. I feel for the next president after Harris. I feel for Harris. I feel for Trump. I feel for Harris, whoever's elected. But I really feel for the next president, because that's when the crunch is going to hit. And we're going to have an entirely, and you're not going to be able to sit in Washington and look out on the world and say, I'm still the hegemon. I'm still the primary power in the world, because you aren't going to be in such a glaring way that it'll be self-evident, even to the dumbest person looking out on the world. That's what's happening. And we need to get beyond Ukraine. We need to get beyond Gaza. And we need to try and, you know, sew up some of the tattered fabric of the American empire. We need an entirely new foreign policy, an entirely new security policy to link with that foreign policy, diplomacy and the military together with the diplomacy leading. And we need new leadership. Badly, Nima, badly. You know, when I watch Elon Musk telling your president to go suck eggs, I know something's wrong. I know something's wrong. And usually when I find something wrong, it's some American billionaire. I was going to say something quite different. American billionaire who's creating the wrong.
Yeah. Lori, let's talk about.
I hope President Lula doesn't have any intention of sucking eggs.
They have the experience of the Venezuelan government in the recent election.
Watch out. Tell him to watch out for his airplane.
Yeah.
You know, we just confiscated Maduro's airplane.
Yeah. It's so strange, Larry. How could that happen? It's unbelievable.
It's not unbelievable to me. I monitored OFAC for a while from my position as a chief staff at the State Department, the Office of Financial Assets Control, and what they were doing in the world in terms of sanctioning people and in some cases sanctioning a discrete individual or a discrete group of individuals, and what they were doing to make sure that those sanctions were adhered to, at least in the first tier. Often people escape them. You know, the people you want to target, they escape them because they got the money to go and escape them. And it's the poor people underneath that you hurt. But individuals like that, where you confiscate their airplane or you confiscate their yacht, we have broken privilege and protocol across the globe in this regard, which is why we have so many people out there who hate our guts. They know what we're doing. They see what we're doing. And you might say, well, that oligarch or that one, they deserved it. But the spinoff effects often hurt lots of people around them. And that's what we do with our sanctions. And as I've said to you before, my understanding, even from OFAC, is we have better than 2 billion people under sanctions. That's a fourth of the world's population. And I think it's higher than that, actually. People say, well, you know, China's under sanctions, so that's a billion. India's under some sanctions, so that's no. We're not counting it that way. We're not counting state. We're counting the people in the state impacted by the sanctions.
Yeah. Larry, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, here is the article that I've sent you. Yeah. It's a GlobeSec security firm insisting Ukraine is winning the war. And at the current situation of the conflict in Ukraine, how they can say that? How is that possible to argue this?
It's the same way Bibi Netanyahu in English and Hebrew says that he's going to defeat Hamas completely. He's localized and they're not so localized, but I understand that the people who are invested in Ukraine, both in the personal apparatus in Ukraine, read Zelensky, and in Ukraine writ large, read the corruption there and all the money they're making off that corruption and the money they don't want China to make, because, you know, that 16-hour railroad trip into the heart of Europe from Pacific ports for China which used to take 4 or 5 days to go around the Horn or go up the Red Sea or wherever else they might go. That's a real threat to these people, because that means China has access to an incredible wealth of intrapo capability, as well as certain things that Ukraine has and others have that China needs. That's their inroad. That's not just a base road initiative. That is a main road initiative, just as is the route that they're contemplating building up the Persian Gulf and into the heart of Russia. There are people who are frightened to death of that. And Volcker, Kurt Volcker, and people like that who are invested in this world, they're a part of it. That's the reason they'll work for Donald Trump and George W. Bush. No problem. Transition from, you know, a bumbling cowboy to a bumbling idiot. No problem. Because I'm not a bumbling idiot, and I'm going to make money off this. And my billionaire buddies are going to make money off this. That's what's really driving these things, I think, right now. It's not really state purpose and state interest, security or foreign policy. It's money. It's money being made. Now, a little bit different in the Levant, but in Europe, it's mainly about money. And it's about putting our fingers, particularly Washington and London, who seem to hate Putin with a visceralness that I can't imagine the depth of. That's part of it, too. How anyone... You know, I can understand how we personalize foreign policy. We do. We make foreign policy instead of state to state, person to person. We like to vilify. If we don't like a state, we take the leader and we vilify him or her. And then we make it a personal contest between our leader and their leader. And that's what we're looking at with Biden and Putin. And to a certain extent, people like Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, and others in the Congress and Putin. Yes, there's money behind it, because they realize that they don't want Ukraine to be subject to that railroad from China, and they don't want Ukraine to be subject to Russia, and they don't want Ukraine sucking down Gazprom's gas and those sorts of things. That's why we blew up the pipeline. We blew up the pipeline, and the Germans accepted it. And the Germans, I'm convinced, at least their leadership, know that we blew up the pipeline, and they accepted it. The new German leadership will not like that at all. So we're looking at, I think, a convulsion about to take place with regard to Ukraine that these people aren't expecting. They just don't see it. They're blind. Kurt Volcker's blind, you know, with $100 bills over his eyeballs. But it's going to happen, I think. Now, you know, part of me says I hope I'm wrong, because this is really going to be catastrophic in many ways. And it's going to be catastrophic at a time when we need comity and cooperation and collaboration, not only to face the climate crisis, but also to do what I've talked to you about many times, renew the nuclear treaty regime. We have no treaties right now, no treaties. Today I heard a man, and Volcker said this to an extent in that article, if it's being reported accurately, we've proven it. Putin won't escalate. Well, he has been, and so has Sergey Lavrov, been very clear that they don't want to escalate. They don't want a war with NATO. But imagine sitting in Ukraine, as it were, and saying, Putin won't escalate. So, Zelensky, you can do anything you want to. You can use those missiles on any target in Russia. You can do whatever you want to. Do another Kursk invasion. Well, can't do that because he doesn't have any soldiers to do it with. And he has been eaten alive on the main defense line. He is being eaten alive on the main defense line. But they're not cognizant of that, or they don't want to be cognizant of it. So let's go on with Ukraine. Ukraine can win. How much nonsense do we have to have before someone sane takes over this situation? Sergey Lavrov the other day about what it would take to get the thing stopped. Clear clarion notes of what is negotiable and what's not. And it's become so clear that it's amazing to me that someone on this side hasn't picked it up and said, okay, let's do this. Let's get this started. Let's have a ceasefire first, and let's go to some peace negotiations. I understand the election coming up, but a really astute person, and I don't attribute that characteristic to Joe Biden anymore at all, But a really astute person would, Blinken, Sullivan, anybody around Biden could start this, would want to turn Ukraine into a positive before the election rather than a negative. And the way to do that is to stop the killing. Stop the killing and get something started. You don't have to finish it by the election. Just don't be looking as if you're cutting and running, which is their real fear. Look as if you're actually bringing a decent settlement, peace agreement, ceasefire, whatever, to that conflict. That could be a real positive, I think. But we don't have any diplomats or any presidents or vice presidents who are competent enough to pull that off. And that's a sad commentary. It's a very sad commentary because we've lost the capacity to be peacemakers. We have lost the capacity.
After the Kursk incursion, Putin was talking about that we cannot negotiate. But today he said that we can negotiate. And he's just willing to negotiate, but there is nobody out there to negotiate with. This is the problem.
And we treat that, at least what I'm hearing, we treat that as if it's weakness and he's losing. We want so badly, so desperately for Ukraine to stand up to Russia and to remain Ukraine and become a member of NATO. We want that so badly that we attribute every statement he makes that is sane, clear, and clarion as being a sign of his weakness. That is a really, if you're talking diplomacy, if you're talking about the quintessential art of diplomacy, that is saying to the other side, I am stupid. I am a troglodyte. You cannot deal with me. That's really what you're saying. If you can't exercise at least some empathy, if you can't put yourself in the other person's shoes, I don't care who it is. I don't care how much you despise the person. If you can't understand the circumstances surrounding a conflict and go in and work diplomatically to resolve that conflict, then you might as well give up. Because your thought is, and I'm sorry to say, this is the thought I encountered in the George W. Bush administration, and it's the thought I think I'm encountering is in this current administration, and that is I can solve everything with a bomb. I can solve everything with the military because the military is efficient. It kills people. It gets them out of my way. Okay, let's have a war. Let's do that. Or if we can't have a war on our own, we'll have a proxy war. We got two proxy wars going on right now, both of which could haul us into it at any moment. That's another thing we don't realize. And Lavrov and Putin have been very explicit about that too. I don't want a war with NATO. I don't want a war with NATO. But if you give me a war with NATO, I will give you what you don't want.
Larry, do you see with the current phase of the conflict, do you see that Poland gonna shoot down Russian missiles?
I had a conversation with a friend in Warsaw 2 days ago, I guess, email conversation back and forth. And he says, I'm not a typical Pole, but I think we're insane here. I think we're absolutely insane. We're doing things that remind me of, and he's a fairly elderly gentleman, lived through a lot of Polish history. They remind me of when we were insane before. And I'm really worried about my country. I'm worried about his country, too. Because there are some insane people there, and being a member of NATO has augmented that insanity and deepened it. And we talked about let's just say we get the situation in Ukraine settled. Is there going to be any pressure from Poland on areas right abutting Poland that Poland has traditionally, historically coveted or even owned? yep, probably, he said, because he is very versed in Polish history. He happens to be a Polish historian. So we've bought a really fraught situation by extending the borders of NATO, as I've said many times before, to countries that have been for millennia the stomping ground of empires, from the Muslims to the Mughals to the name the empire, and they have been from time to time a part of that empire or a stomping ground of that empire. And now we have them enshrouded in Article 5 and NATO. That's not a denigration of those countries. It's, I remember an old Hungarian saying, Father Arpad in Hungary, you know, Father Arpad should not have stopped at Buda and Pest. He should have kept walking till he got to the English Channel and then put down his flag, you know, because that's a very dangerous division of geography. And now we've incorporated that dangerous division of geography into NATO. And Ukraine is the first example of how divisive that can be and how combustible that can be, because we were talking about them being a member of NATO, just as my president talked about Georgia in the public square being a member of NATO. Putin showed what he thought of that, and we didn't take the lesson. We didn't take the lesson. Ukraine is far more strategic in terms of Moscow's existential threat syndrome than Georgia. But we don't take any notes because we are number one. No one tells us what to do. We are number one. Well, I got news for us. We are not number one anymore. And that's a very dangerous idea to hold on to when you're wrong.
Larry, if they go that far to shoot down Russian missiles, do you think that they're going to be alone or NATO going to back them?
I think if there's a concrete piece of evidence to Putin and to the Russian military that NATO has instrumentally joined the conflict, whether it's from Polish soil or from the anywhere else in NATO soil, that then they will feel the right, and international law-wise, they have the right to attack that point. Now, do they have to attack that specific point? Does it have to be proportional? Yes, it should be, but in their lexicon, it might be, okay, you've done it. Now I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it to you in a way that really hurts. And I hope you'll stop. I hope we don't go escalate any further. And then, of course, the people say, well, like at this conference that you were telling me about, well, Putin has shown that he won't escalate. He's shown he's a paper tiger. He just uses nuclear weapons as a threat. I think he's been very circumspect, as has Sergei Lavrov, in their comments about nuclear weapons. And I think the gist of it is, we don't want to use nuclear weapons. We don't want to use nuclear weapons. But if we do, ours are better than yours. Yeah. Everyone loses if we use nuclear weapons. Everyone. And certainly the region. If it could be constrained to the region, and I'm not sure it could be constrained to the region. That's the real problem. Especially now that we have no talk shops. We have no treaty environment. We have no one to pick up the phone and call. We have no one that even, I think, resides in the world of nuclear arms control anymore. The knowledge is gone. The expertise is gone. It's all disappeared like smoke. And we're sitting with 9 nuclear weapon states, several of them armed to the teeth, particularly in terms of their regions like Pakistan and India, China building out probably to thousands of nuclear weapons now when they only had 400 to 600 before. We're in a very, very dangerous world, and no one seems to recognize it. That's very worrisome.
Yeah. Scott Ritter wrote an article on Consortium News, and the title is On a Highway to Hell. And yeah. This is the way it's beautiful. I suggest everybody who's watching this podcast just read the article. It's just brilliant.
He's right.
And it doesn't seem right now. We've learned that Germany, the government in Germany, is saying that all the weapons that we're sending to Ukraine is in the hand of Ukrainians, and they're gonna decide how they would use it against Russia. This means that they can use to attack Russia on the Russian soil. And this
reminds me in a small way, because we've advanced so far in terms of weaponry and killing, but in a small way, of the buildup in Spain through the 30s that gave Hitler an opportunity to test the Wehrmacht, especially the Luftwaffe. And all the people who got involved on both sides, the losing side ultimately, and the, well, I don't want to say winning side, but the side that prevailed in Spain. That's what that was. That was a testing ground for the Führer. That was a testing ground for the Wehrmacht. That was a testing ground for fascism. That's what Ukraine is today. That's what we're using Ukraine for today. And we are Hitler.
Thank you so much, Larry. Great pleasure as always talking with you. And enjoy.
Thank you, Larry. Good format. You're